Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We were to hear two cases this afternoon, but as it turns out, we will be hearing one, and you are it. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofino. And I understand both sides are ready?
Yes,
sir. Okay. If you'll call the case, please. All right, please.
Please, the court and counsel. I'm not sure exactly where to begin with the variations in the testimony of the officers, which I think is kind of the crux of where I have a problem in this case. Obviously, I wasn't there at trial, and I think counsel, I think, was there for closing arguments, and so but I'm bothered by the fact that there are variations between the hearing in 2009 for the bond, and then later on there are also variations even in the 2011, and there's a question about whether or not did the officers at the time they went out to my client's home, what was the real purpose in going out there? Was my client a suspect? If you believe one officer that says he went off to the police department or went to his department to start filling out a search warrant, another officer says they're out there just to deliver bad news to the closest or next of kin. So we have, in the very beginning, we have a discrepancy between what the officers are testifying to. At some point, my client becomes a suspect, but there's, again, because of the discrepancy in the testimony, you're not sure, well, did it become a suspect prior to these two key officers going out there to his home, or was he already a suspect, and did they have a basis for starting to fill out a search warrant at that point? Did he become a suspect during the initial contact that the Officer Murphy has in talking with him about his brother's death? At what point do they then suspect that the truck is a piece of evidence, is all under cover of night? They go upon my client's property. They have no search warrant at that point. And again, if the conversation between what the officer is saying, well, we didn't suspect he was a suspect, or we didn't believe he was a suspect until we started interviewing him, then what becomes the basis for going on my client's property to take a look at the vehicle, the pickup truck, that then becomes a kind of a major centerpiece for key pieces of evidence in this case. So I'm troubled by these discrepancies, and there's no explanation, and I know that there were different prosecutors between the 09 hearing and the 2011 hearing. There were different criminal defense attorneys between the 09 and the 2011 hearing. I suspect that the trial defense attorney was unaware that these officers had a different version of events back in when they testified in 2009. So I'm troubled by those things, and I don't know exactly how you reconcile these discrepancies. Obviously, the jury did not hear these discrepancies and never got chance. I guess in the most basic sense, the officers were never confronted with what were apparent contradictions between the 09 and the 2011 hearing.
Isn't that just a matter for cross-examination?
Well, it would be, except that with the attorney for the defense not being aware of what they had said in the 09, he's kind of blindsided at the time of the trial. So it's unusual that I would have, I cannot think in the 30 years I've been an attorney where I've seen a discrepancy between two sets of hearings. And of course, we also have two different judges that end up hearing these things. So It's almost like you got one group of people involved in the 09, then you have a whole different group of people involved in the 2011 trial of this case. But that's the centerpiece of where I see the problem for the state's side of this case. And I think that with them going on to the property and then beginning to do blood swabs on the running board of my client's pickup truck is a problem.
But they didn't do the swabs until they had a warrant, correct?
It's my understanding they did the swabs prior to the warrant. I mean, that's why I say there's something of conflicts in the discrepancy about at what point is my client a suspect? At what point did they have a right to go on my client's property and begin taking swabs off his pickup truck on the running board? And what's their basis for going on the property to begin with, since it's all under cover of night?
When you're talking about, excuse me, the custodial interrogation.
Right.
What specific statements are you complaining about? I'm not.
The only thing that they go on supposedly to inform my client, and then they say that he blurts out this statement that about these emails, and then he's also that there was some sort of a tension or bad blood, I think maybe is one of the terms that might have been used in the testimony, between David Honish, the deceased, and my client, Mark Honish.
Well, if you're complaining about custodial interrogation, there has to be a question,
right,
and an answer.
Right.
What questions and answers are, because I guess I overlooked it in the brief. I don't really, but I had a question about that. What specific questions and answers are you complaining about?
Well, when they went out there to deliver the news at that point, I think my client took their statements to him as like he's being interrogated at that point, and he blurts out this information. But you're right, there was no actual question, at least in the testimony. I mean, my primary concern has been over the issue of them going on the property and doing the blood swabs.
Okay.
That's been my primary focus. I mean, that was more of an ancillary thing. I put that in there, but one could maybe, because there's such a confusion about what was the purpose of them going out there to begin with? Was it to deliver the news? I think that was part of it. At what point does my client then become a suspect? What point do they suspect that he's the one that did this?
But how do we, if the confusion wasn't before the trial court and no one was aware of it, how do we look at that?
Well, I would hope that our law enforcement, we would hope that they'd be utterly consistent, at least on these key points, not that they're going to come back and make variations in their testimony.
Sure, of course. But I'm saying the standard of review that we apply is we look at the evidence that was introduced at trial.
Right.
And the fact that there was not cross-examination about some prior inconsistent statements, I'm not sure that we, how are you urging us to go behind what's on the record and look at these prior inconsistent statements that were never introduced at trial?
Well, I'm actually going further than that. I'm trying to figure out how they have a basis for going on my client's property, not just that there was a prior inconsistent statement, but if you believe one set of statements, they have no basis for going on the property. If you believe another set of statements, they maybe have a basis, but then it's now in conflict with what they said, testified to previously. And that's a problem I have with the case. I'm just troubled with something that I would expect to be utterly consistent. You know, why did they go on the property to begin with? And were there exigent circumstances that allowed them to start doing blood swabbing before there was a search warrant?
So you're talking about seizure of the blood? Or, you know, if you're lawfully in the place where you see evidence that's in plain view, that's immediately apparent that it's evidence, you can seize it. Are you saying it wasn't immediately apparent? They weren't lawfully.
They were on my
on
client's
property?
Well, depending on which set of stories you believe, if they were 15 feet into my client's property, and it's dark, you know, unless they've got like flashlights, if they're really looking at it real close, then there's some question about why were they on his property to begin with.
You're saying they can't go up to the door, knock on the door, and
they can do that.
Well, they're on his property. If they walk past his pickup on the way to the door to knock on the door.
Well, if the pickup is 15 feet into the property, and there's some question about how, again, what do I believe in this? There's a 4 or 5, I think one officer says it's 4 or 5 feet. Another one says it's 15 feet. If this vehicle's 15 feet, the question is, do they have a right at that point to go on the property and start looking for evidence at that point?
So you're saying the record will show that they spread out on the property and search things and didn't just go to the door to knock on the door and try to talk to somebody?
Well, I don't know that they ever got to the door. They go up to the pickup truck, look at it real closely, and then at some point they go back out on the street and just watch. They never knock on the door. My client then comes out about right before 6 o'clock, backs out his pickup truck, and then that's when they stop him. Now there's some question again about they claim that they see him lick his thumb and do something, you know, and then there's some question about there being some sort of an S thing on the side of the door, but this thing about the running board with the blood droplets on it, there's just, I don't know at what point they actually gathered that evidence, but it certainly was before they search warrant.
I don't remember. Was the blood part of the basis for the search warrant?
Well, the pickup truck was part of the search warrant.
I understand it was to search the pickup truck, but what was in the affidavit as the basis for searching the pickup truck? Was the blood any part of that?
I don't recall there being a mention of blood on the pickup truck, just that the pickup truck was something they wanted to look at real closely.
Mr. Hughes, in the state's brief on page 15, there's a discussion about the blood in the truck, and it's testimony of Ranger Murphy, mm-hmm. and what the state's brief quotes is that appellant proceeded to make calls for about 30 minutes and Murphy did not stop or restrict. Within a few minutes, as the sun began to rise, Murphy observed drops of blood on appellant's truck.
Right.
Drops of blood were below the previously noted S wipe on the driver's door of appellant's truck. Now, doesn't that lay to rest testimony by Ranger Murphy about what happened about the blood before the warrant arrived?
Well, the problem I have is that you also have other testimony that says that they collected these blood swabs between 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. before my client even came out and they even saw my client.
Well, I didn't see that. Maybe I can find that in the record when I go back through it again. In terms of your client being a suspect, if you go back to the actually quoted emails that are on page 12 and 13 of the state's brief.
Okay.
Finding emails like this in the truck beside the body of a person who's been shot twice would seem to be at least some indication that you might give some amount of suspicion that he might have been shot by the guy who was in the emails.
Well, that's I'll have to concede that. That's a pretty strong point in the case. Those emails were very damaging to my client's side.
I'm just trying to reconcile that with about the officer's contention that what they were doing was an investigation and a determination of prospective charging with the crime in the original investigation that they were making before they actually got a warrant, but then after the warrant got there, it moved to a different process in the investigation.
And that's what at least that's part of what I understand that they end up saying. He becomes a, like, the main suspect as they begin to question him or talk to him. I guess it's not question, but really talk to him. And he then makes some statements that lead them to believe that he then becomes the target of this search warrant.
And your concern is that the for that the, is that Mr. Harnish, Fourth Amendment rights were violated by what transpired in the activities before the warrant arrived.
Right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon. The best way to answer these issues is to first be aware that when it comes to reasonable suspicion, the subjective intent or what the officer said their reasons were for going out there is not as important as the totality of the facts and circumstances looked at objectively.
No, wait a minute. Reasonable suspicion includes a concept of an exigent circumstance. So when you're stopping somebody on the road, yeah, you can do it with a reasonable suspicion because there's an exigent circumstance, and that is they are moving. But this is somebody's home.
The best way to answer that question is to think, what did Texas Ranger Murphy and Investigator Kish know when they did that? What were the facts available to them?
Did they know enough to get a warrant?
When they stopped that truck, they had already looked at the truck from the street and in the driveway, which, as I've pointed out in our brief, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in that on the exterior of that pickup truck.
When it's on the road.
When it's parked in the driveway. This court has held, in Romo and other Texas courts have held, that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in those kind of circumstances. And because there was no reasonable expectation of privacy, Murphy and Kish acted appropriately when they looked at the exterior of that truck without a warrant, even though they went on his property to do so. And counsel talks a lot about the inconsistencies between their testimony. I grant that there are some. I don't see them as being nearly as nefarious, I think, as he sees them. First of all, there was maybe some discrepancy between the two on how far the truck was up in the driveway by a few feet. The jury did hear that testimony, by the way, that discrepancy. And the issue at the bond hearing wasn't about how they searched and got the warrant. The issue at the bond hearing was whether the appellant was a flight risk.
Where was the driveway in relation to the front door of the house?
The driveway it's a front entry drive, and he lives, the home is on a cul-de-sac type street towards the end, and the driveway is at the front of the home. So it's a front entry, not a rear entry. And not far from someplace that would be, or it is far from someplace that would be private. You know, it's not like around the back of the house or anything like that.
Well, is it on the way to the front door, or do you have to go out of your way to get to the pickup on the way to the front door?
The pickup, when they rolled up, the pickup's right there in the driveway. I mean, well, they could see what they could see from the street was that they could see the tracks of the truck matching the width of the tracks approximately that were left next to David Harnish's truck. They could see the mud on the side of the truck where you would expect to see mud on that side of the truck given what they had seen at the crime scene. They had that information. These are all things they saw before they even got out of their car. And when they got there, they knew what? They knew that there was this truck, Mr. David Honish's truck, parked off the side of the road there in Argyle. The engine was running. It's got blood spatter in it. There's no exit wound on the head, and the splatter came back out towards the shooter's vehicle. They pretty much know that. They, of course, have these emails. They have these tracks that look like off-road tires. The officers talked a lot about it. Looked like these. That must have been a big pickup truck or something like, or SUV or something like that. And so they had all of this information. They also had called, by that point, they had called Lori Hawk, who confirmed that there had been a feud between the two. And so they thought, well, let's go out there and check this out. Regardless of going out there on a death notification or anything else, they've got that information. They testified at trial that he wasn't a suspect until after they had stopped, after they had talked to him for a few minutes. They've got some pretty strong, reasonable suspicion to stop him when he's leaving. And the exigent circumstance is, first of all, that it had been raining. There's the evidence that it had been raining. They're, based on what they can see on this truck, they know they need to preserve the mud and what looks like blood on there to keep him from, they don't know if he's going to wash his truck. They know he's a pilot, and so they don't know if he's trying to flee.
Did they take the samples of blood off the truck before they got a warrant?
My understanding is that, excuse me, the first thing with regard to the blood was that when they stopped him, they saw the swipe on the side of the door.
It was still dark. They saw that from the street.
No, that was when they stopped him. As soon as the appellant opened his door, their testimony was that as soon as the appellant opened his door, they could see the swipe on the door and the headlights of their car. But it was still dark then. But not long after that, that was about 6 in the morning, not long after that, the sun started coming up. And they could see the blood spatter on the door above where that swipe had been.
When they walked on the property.
They not saw the mud when they walked on the property, and they used flashlights and saw what they thought might be blood. But it was dark. There's, to my knowledge, and please forgive me if I'm mistaken here, I don't believe that the blood was used as part of getting the warrant. The truck was something that they wanted to use, of course, and to search. If I'm remembering the affidavit for the arrest warrant correctly, there wasn't a mention of blood. And I apologize if I'm mistaken there. That's why it's important to note what were the facts at each stage of this. With respect to those custodial statements, I do want to mention that they occurred immediately after the stop, and there's a question, I haven't really argued this in my brief, but there could be a question even of whether he was even in custody at that point.
Was he free to leave?
Well, he testified that his own testimony was that it was about 10 or 15 minutes into this deal before he felt like he was in custody. And they weren't interrogating him. The first thing that they asked him was, what's your name? Do you have a brother? And notified him of his brother's death. And within just that first few seconds or minute or two is when he said, well, I guess you found those emails in the truck. And they hadn't even mentioned that his brother had been found in a truck. So there's a question of whether he was even in custody at that point. And yes, they had lit him up. And yes, they stopped him and asked him, could you pull back into your driveway? Would you mind doing that? But his own testimony, the appellant's own testimony, was that he agreed to do that. He didn't mind doing that. And he pulled back up into the driveway and they talked.
And if he had taken off, because you said their whole purpose was to prevent his leaving, he would have been arrested. That's not free to leave.
Well, there's no testimony that they that their whole purpose was to keep him from leaving.
I thought you said they knew he was a pilot and he could have been going to wash the truck.
Well, they also know that there's been an assault, reasonable suspicion that there's an assault family violence offense that has occurred. There's at least three different things.
Why didn't they get a warrant?
They did get a warrant.
They were sitting out there for, an hour with all this information.
The judge
never tried to get a warrant
No, they did. As soon as they got out there and saw that, they called and they had a Flower Mound police officer at his office, and they were telling him, all right, put this in it. And the judge McFarling in Denton signed the warrant as soon as he got into the office that morning, just after 8 o'clock. And they did not search the house or the inside of the truck or anything like that until that warrant was there on the scene. In fact, the appellant had an attorney there by the time the warrant was there, and that attorney looked at the warrant, is my understanding.
Did they take the blood samples before or after getting the warrant?
They took blood samples after getting the warrant. They saw the blood before. I know they scraped mud before they had a warrant. Whether they scraped any blood, I couldn't say, but I know that when they did the blood that was used in the analysis at trial and that was sponsored, that blood had been taken when the truck had been covered up, towed, pursuant to a warrant, back to the Sallyport at the police station.
Procedurally, what kind of objection was made to the evidence on the pickup truck and in the pickup truck?
There was a motion to suppress, and they held that after voir dire, but before they started evidence.
Okay, a motion to suppress everything?
Motion to suppress that physical evidence, and there was another motion to suppress his statements that were made after the stop. And
so there's no question of preservation?
Oh, no, I have not argued preservation. I invite the court to find a preservation argument, but I didn't feel that it was necessary to make that. But, of course, there's always that question.
Well, not always.
Not always. But I think it was preserved.
Okay.
Appreciate
your candor.
Yeah. I would like to point out, he raises a sufficiency issue, and I want to point out that just as a matter of sufficiency, or as a matter, even really this could relate to the suppression issues as well, that we have the murder weapon that was found a few days later. and it's circumstantial, but the finding of that weapon had absolutely nothing to do with the search, I don't want to call it a search, but the looks at the truck and then the search pursuant to a warrant of appellant's home and truck. And so presumably, had the motion to suppress been granted, we still would have had everything that occurred at the crime scene, and we still would have had a murder weapon that was pretty well linked up to appellant. And so even if that motion to suppress had been granted, the state's position is that the conviction would still be stand and still be valid, and that the jury would have had ample evidence on which to convict. And I do also want to point out that I may have mentioned this already, so I apologize if I already mentioned this, but the defendant's own testimony was that he didn't feel like he was in custody until 10 or 15 minutes after that stop. And so that's a huge factor in whether Miranda was even triggered at that point. Appellant, I don't know whether which or what statements he wants to suppress, but regardless of that, the state's position is, as a threshold issue, that we need to even look whether he was in custody at that point at all. I see my time is almost up. Are there any more questions? If not, I will have a seat. State prays that the court would affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
The rebuttal that I can think of
rebuttal that I can think of would be, it's my understanding from reading of this that this there were four drops of blood that were swabbed off the running board of this vehicle prior to the search warrant, and that the argument, at least at the that what they argued at the time was that the potential for rain created exigent circumstances. But when Officer Keish testifies at trial, he says there is no exigent circumstance. So again, I'm just troubled by the inconsistency of what I see in this case. I mean, was there exigent circumstances, the swabbing of the blood? I just have problems with this. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming all this way to answer our questions and present your case. Your case is submitted, and we do appreciate your argument. It has helped clarify the issues and the facts in this case. So we appreciate your coming here. And you're now excused to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.